Let me show how the learned and the biological components of aging form a personal pattern that defines how a person will age. A patient of mine named Perry, age 67, was a retired realtor whose wife became worried when he began to seem different from his usual self. When she brought him in for examination, Perry was listless and unresponsive to questions, and his wife commented that when she came home late from shopping or visiting a friend, she often found her husband staring at the television, barely noticing that she had walked into the room. When I asked Perry how he felt, all he said was, "I'm just getting old. There's nothing wrong with me that being 20 years younger wouldn't fix." But in fact, the Perry of 20 years ago was already cultivating the seeds of habit and belief that grew into what he is today. Like many people of his generation, Perry had outlived both his parents. His expectations for himself are probably strongly marked by having seen them age. His father retired to a rocking chair at 65 and henceforth took very little interest in making a new life for himself. He gained weight, drank a lot more than before, and read newspapers. Within 3 years of getting his gold watch, he suffered a heart attack. His doctors advised him to give up all activity, reassigning him to an invalid's life. Within a year, however, a second coronary followed, this one fatal. Perry's mother, on the other hand, remained active all her life. Like many working women in the past, she also took care of her husband and family, doing all the cooking, housework, and laundry, while at the same time holding down an accounting job. Whatever else can be said about such a life, it kept her in much better physical condition than her husband. She had no heart or blood pressure problems, and she didn't smoke. However, she drifted into apathy and loneliness after her husband's death and seemed to lose her sense of purpose. With no one to take care of and not wanting to be a burden to her children, she became semi-reclusive. Eventually, after a series of strokes, she died. Perry's outlook on aging has been programmed by these two life stories. And although he probably did not consciously see himself winding up like his parents, he appeared to be on the threshold of duplicating how they aged by unconsciously adopting their beliefs. He had lost control of the aging process by losing touch with his own awareness. Because my medical specialty is endocrinology, Perry and his wife sought my advice in determining if he had a thyroid condition. Among the disorders that can mimic aging is hypothyroidism, or thyroid deficiency, which causes an abnormal decrease in metabolism, making its victims slow and dull, their hair gray and their skin wrinkled. Perry, however, exhibited adequate thyroid levels, throwing the burden of explanation back upon other influences. Whenever anyone seems to be aging so badly, the signs of senility, feebleness, and disability are present. It's important to investigate his or her lifestyle. It is estimated that between a third and half of senility comes from such treatable factors as malnutrition, the side effects from drugs, smoking, alcohol abuse, dehydration, depression, and inactivity. All these factors begin with a failure of awareness, stemming either from neglect or from habit. Alone or in combination, any of these components can dramatically affect how a person looks and acts. Now consider Perry's condition with the above list in mind. Since his wife had already told me he sat around the house most of the day, physical inactivity was already a given. On being questioned, Perry revealed that he had started drinking more since his retirement and often began early in the day. When he worked, he had set himself a rule never to pour a drink before 5, but as he ruefully said, "My self-discipline is shot, I guess it happens." Being borderline hypertensive, he was taking blood pressure medication, but he had not had the dosage changed in 2 years. "I try not to take the pills unless my pressure's gone up," he confided. I asked how he knew when his blood pressure was up. "You know, if I feel tense or the wife is nagging me," he replied. "In fact, hypertension, despite its name, does not coincide with being tense and indeed has no overt symptoms at all. And Perry's medication, in order to be effective, must be taken every day." A huge number of preventable aging problems can be traced to the indiscriminate use of prescription drugs. Unless one is alert to this danger, mixing medications becomes a growing habit with many people as they age. Sleeping pills and diuretics are among the most common drugs used by older people. Tranquilizers are also extremely common, along with aspirin and assorted other painkillers taken for arthritis. Besides abusing these drugs by taking too many too often, older people often become careless about having their dosages monitored regularly by a doctor. Many tend to forget when to discontinue a medication and which drug is meant for which condition. Many older Americans drink, and the combination of drugs and alcohol is almost always dangerous. Therefore, a person's medication should always be thoroughly reviewed at the first sign of physical or mental symptoms of abuse or misuse. In Perry's case, I also strongly suspected hidden low-level depression. Someone who watches television all day and pays no attention when his wife walks into the room could easily be mildly or clinically depressed. The typical old person sitting quietly in his corner, once accepted as an image of normal aging, was probably depressed. To become silent, withdrawn, apathetic, anxious, and childishly helpless are common signs of this condition. Chronic fatigue is often a physical outcome of depression, accounting for up to 50% of cases, and certain severe depressions specifically afflict older people for reasons not yet known. However, many cases of depression can be linked directly to social and personal problems. A person who feels useless, discarded, uncared for, or burdensome to his family can hardly help but fall into depression. Aging as a whole is a vicious circle. When people expect to be withdrawn, isolated and useless after a certain age, they create the very conditions that justify their beliefs. Our deepest assumptions are the triggers for physical changes. It would be naive then to think that just listing a few preventable causes for aging could actually prevent it. What good does it do to tell someone like Perry to quit drinking if he feels despair? When the business of growing old is a morass of hidden feelings that people find too difficult to face, drinking becomes a merciful anesthetic compared to living with dread and lost hope. It is far easier to follow one's internal programming than to break through into new territory. But over time, our hidden programming robs us of choice more and more, making it harder to break the bonds of self-destructive behavior. In this regard, aging is much like addiction. The person feels that he is still in control when in fact the behavior is controlling him. From the outside, I could see this in Perry. He was transforming himself into a dying man before my eyes, and the tragedy was that he could not see that he was doing it to himself. And needless to say, the fact that the calendar said that Perry was 67 years old was almost insignificant compared to the effects of his way of living and his patterns of thinking. It is very frightening to watch an old person give up his desire for life, and it is extremely difficult to show him what he is doing. When life becomes meaningless, the body's sustaining energy seems to drain silently away like a leaky battery. And if we look closer, we can prove that this draining away of vitality, curiosity, and the will to live is controllable and in fact has nothing to do with normal aging. The body is self-replenishing. It renews its energies automatically after times of depletion. No matter how severe the stress, once the body has responded, it returns to a state of balance. This tendency to remain in balance is completely necessary to life and proves to be a key survival mechanism. Instead of coming up with a fixed number to answer the question, how old are you? We need to arrive at a sliding scale that shows how fast our chronological, biological, and psychological ages are moving in relationship to one another. When gerontologists try to predict longevity, many psychological components must be taken into account to accurately determine if the aging process is being accelerated or retarded. Negative influences include depression, job dissatisfaction, and excessive worry, while a happy marriage, the presence of close friends, and the ability to express feelings easily are all positive forces. As you can see, there is much more to psychological age than the cliche, you're only as old as you think you are. And changing your psychological age involves interweaving personal and social factors. Among the major factors are several we have touched upon. The importance of a regular daily and work routine is emphasized by almost every longevity study. Job satisfaction emerges as the most reliable indicator that a person is at low risk for a heart attack, while being dissatisfied with one's job puts one at extremely high risk. Living alone is precarious, while being happily married indicates that one will age slowly. The combinations of these factors become extremely complex, mirroring the complexity of one's personal life. Gerontologists have gone to great lengths to try to quantify some of these factors with plausible results. Someone who has lived alone for 4 years, for example, would have a slightly different psychological age from someone who has lived alone for 8 years. The relative value assigned to having a regular daily routine is considered 3 times more important than having a satisfying sex life, while being optimistic about the future cancels out point for point the negative trait of not having a hobby. But I have some reservations about any attempt to quantify someone's personal makeup. No itemized list can quantify intangible qualities such as being able to give of oneself or having regard for others. In general, this is a limitation of modern psychology with its over-reliance on numbers and impersonal data. One unusual study bridged the gap rather neatly, however. A University of California psychologist taped the conversations of nearly 600 men, a third of whom were suffering from heart disease, the rest of whom were healthy. The psychologist kept count of how often each man used the words I, me, and mine. When the results were compared with the frequency of heart disease, the men who most often used the first-person pronoun had the highest risk of heart trouble. In addition, by tracking the same subjects for several years, it was found that the more a man habitually talked about himself, the greater the chance he would actually have a coronary. Counting the times a person said I was an elegantly simple yet ingenious way to quantify self-absorption. And to me, there's something very fitting in the notion that the less you open your emotional heart to others, the more your physical heart suffers. It's an idea that appeals to our intuitive sense that an open, loving person will age well. By nurturing your inner life, and by nurturing those around you in turn, you can use the power of awareness to defeat aging at its source. Now, recently there's a whole body of literature on DHEA as a supplement. And there's a whole body of literature that's saying that DHEA in fact alters biological aging. There's some literature that is emerging on melatonin, and all I can say to you is it looks good, but I can't say that the scientific data at the moment says definitely this is going to work. Now, just want to say, how about the spiritual insight into all this? The mental attitude. And I think the mental techniques that influence aging are here. Changing your internal reference point from ego-based to spirit-based, because time is manufactured and metabolized by the ego. The ego creates time. When ego entered our evolution, then death also entered our consciousness. So only the ego is that which dies. The spirit is the underlying ground beyond that. Present moment awareness. This is the state of awareness that creates the least amount of entropy in the physical body. Uncertainty as part of the overall order of things, or what we call the wisdom of uncertainty, which is, I accept that as my anchor, to be comfortable with uncertainty, because certainty is the prison of the past. It's the stale repetition of outworn ideas in the past. An attitude that changes the only constant and is infused with non-change, because in the midst of change there's always the non-change of the observer. And that little exercise that we did in the midst of observation, turning back to the observer and experiencing the observer as the non-changing factor in the midst of time-bound change. The observer is the timeless factor in the midst of time-bound change. And the knowledge that entropy is a function in the universe, but it holds no threat if it is under the control of the infinite organizing power of spirit. Again, changing your reference point back to spirit all the time. So a few years ago, with all that, I came about with these ideas that I want you to go home with, which in a way capture the essence of all the Ayurvedic techniques that you've learned this week. First, listening to the body's wisdom. The body sends out only two signals: signal of comfort and a signal of discomfort. So all behavior should be such that it, in a sense, always creates that experience of comfort. I'm not talking now about physical intense exercise, which is a part of the routine. I'm talking about generally the behaviors that create emotional comfort more than anything else. Listening to the body's emotions means listening to the wisdom of the body. Maintaining life-centered present moment awareness. This moment is as it should be. The past is gone, the future is not here. At this moment, I'm free of both. That notion that this is the only moment that really is. The past is an imagination, the future is also an imagination. The only reality is this moment. The experience of silence. Talked about that. Relinquishing the need for approval and control. The need for approval and control are ego-based needs that are based on fear, and all motivation based on fear creates entropy. Practicing defenselessness, which means relinquishing the need to defend a point of view. It doesn't mean that you don't have a point of view, it just means don't have the need to defend it anymore. It's part of the law of least effort. Do less and accomplish more, because 99.9% of our energy is expended in proving that we are right, in defending our need to be right. So give up being right, totally and completely. That's what defenselessness is. Now, I had the good fortune to speak on this a few years ago at Mr. Gorbachev's World Forum in San Francisco. I spent the whole evening talking about the law of least effort. At the end of the talk, Mr. Gorbachev came to me and he said, "You know, I understand this principle very well. I practiced it on Mr. Bush a few years ago." So I said, "What happened?" He said, "At the height of the Cold War, during a summit, I went to him and I said, 'George, I'm going to do something terrible to you.'" And he said, Bush sort of was alarmed. He said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm going to deprive you of an enemy. I'm going to deprive you of an enemy. We are going to become defenseless." And he said, "We did that. Now they pay all our bills." a lovely seven. So, relinquishing the need for approval, practicing defenselessness, using the mirror of relationship. The mirror of relationship, which means every relationship is a mirror. Those that we love and those that we hate are both mirrors of the self. We're attracted to those people in whom we find traits that we want in ourselves. And we are repelled by those people in whom we find traits that we deny in ourselves. So just to ask yourself this question, why am I attracted to this person? What is it they have that I want in myself? Can I keep borrowing these traits or should I become these traits? And also, what's repelling me? What am I denying in my own self? Using the mirror of relationship for conscious evolution allows us to shed the burden of judgment. Because you can't do it otherwise consciously. Eliminating toxins from our life. And that includes eliminating toxic people from our life. Toxic relationships, toxic emotions, toxic food, toxic chemicals, they all have the same effect. They create toxins in the body. Now you can even measure these toxins, all these hydrogen peroxide and singlet oxygen and all the things that go along in the name of radicals, hydroxy radical and so on. Replacing fear-based behavior with love-based behavior, that means internal points of reference is shifting from ego to spirit, and a deeper understanding that only come with the evolution of consciousness, that behind the mask of matter there is a deeper reality, and that as we explore this deeper reality we have access to states of awareness that we never recognized we had. And these states of awareness are beyond waking, dreaming and sleeping. I mentioned them the other day as in introduction, glimpsing the soul, cosmic consciousness, refined cosmic consciousness or divine consciousness, and ultimately unity consciousness. And I'll just say a few words because I can only say a few things. The rest is experience, and hopefully we'll share that experience as we explore the world of spirit and consciousness together in future sessions. So the fourth state, beyond dreaming, waking and sleeping, is glimpsing the soul. It's when we step into the gap. And during that experience, there is restful awareness, there's a heightened state of alertness, and there is the beginnings of the intuitive response, the non-linear, contextual, relational intelligence that orchestrates the infinite diversity of the universe. In this experience, which occurs, of course, through putting attention on the observer and through meditation, we have the first glimpse of a deeper reality. Beyond the fourth state of consciousness is the fifth state of consciousness, which is called cosmic state of consciousness, which creates, just like the fourth state, restful awareness, creates its own physiology, its own brainwave pattern, its own cardiac pattern, its own immune function, etc. The fifth state of consciousness does the same. The fifth state of consciousness is called cosmic consciousness. It is the simultaneity of local and non-local awareness at the same time, which means the attention is on the observer and the observed at the same time. It's also called an alert witnessing of the roles we play. So I'm playing the role of a speaker and author right now. I also play the role of a father, I play the role of a son, I play the role of a husband, I play the role of a doctor. I'm not the roles I'm playing. I'm the alert witness of the roles I'm playing. It might be my destiny to play an infinity of roles, but I'm not the roles I'm playing. So in that alert witnessing, what happens is there's a state of awareness where there is the non-judgmental awareness of waking, dreaming and sleeping. Dreams are lucid because there's a part of you who's watching the dream. Even deep sleep has a part of you that's fully awake to the physiology of deep sleep. Body, and mind and brain function. Activity. There's a part of you that's caught up in activity and there's a part of you that's totally detached, which is what the spiritual traditions say, to be in this world and not of it. That's local and non-local awareness at the same time. Now in this state, if somebody were to measure your brain waves would show the same physiology as in deep meditation, even if you were playing tennis. So it's a very interesting physiological functioning that correlates with cosmic consciousness. You're in the midst of dynamic activity, but your silent observer is not overshadowed by the observation. And your physiology reflects that. Your brain waves reflect that. Your cardiac coherence reflects that. The electromagnetic fields around your body reflect that. That's cosmic consciousness. Here what happens is, we go beyond the intuitive response into the creative response, because in fact what we start experiencing more and more are coincidences and improbabilities, the conspiracy of improbabilities. The conspiracy of improbabilities that starts to weave a meaningful incident in our lives. And that's what good luck is. It's opportunity meeting preparedness. The sixth state of consciousness, which is beyond cosmic consciousness, can also call refined cosmic consciousness, is to have the experience of the observer in the observed, which means I'm looking at this flower and I'm now, you know, it's not something that you make a mood of. This is something that happens with the evolution of consciousness. Anybody can make a mood of anything. That's one of the problems with all spiritual disciplines. You don't know if somebody is lying or telling the truth. Only you know. Only you know. And if you know, then you don't even feel the need to tell anybody about it. So the sixth state of consciousness is to see the object of your observation both in its local and in its non-local nature. So as I'm looking at the flower, I see the flower, but you also see the rainbow and the sunshine and the earth and the water and the wind and the void of space and the vast history of creation that brought this to where it is right now. That's going beyond the mere appearance into the underlying reality. And when you go beyond even that, then you see and cognize the same spirit. That's the sixth state of consciousness, where meaningful coincidence and synchronicity accelerates to the point where everything seems to be miraculous, because that's the experience. And finally, the state of consciousness, which is the merging of the spirit within with the merging of the spirit over there, where suddenly, because the ego is no longer the internal reference point, the environment begins to be experienced as your extended physical body. So there is the experience in awareness that the environment is not separate from me, it's my physical body. The earth is actually my physical body, and the trees are actually my lungs. Now, intellectually, that's actually true, because we're recycling the dust that makes us with the dust out there. We're recycled dirt, basically. We're recycling that. So intellectually, that's okay to know that. But I'm not talking intellectually. I'm talking about experientially, to look at the earth and the trees and experience them as my own physical being. So what Rumi says in one of his poems, says, let the waters settle and you will see stars and moon mirrored in your being. It's a state of awareness which goes beyond the miraculous, because in fact everything is a miracle. So that's the course of evolution, metabiological evolution, beyond biological evolution, that hopefully we're all going to collectively explore as the years unroll, since we're going to have the wisdom of aging with the biology of youth. And if there's only one word that I can use to express all that, it would be the experience of love. Not as a sentiment, not as an emotion, but as the ultimate truth at the heart of creation. The experiential knowledge of unity consciousness. All of us basically communicate through love. That is the primary message being delivered in relationships, though it can be extremely distorted in the transmission or reception. The other person serves as a communications link to what your higher self is trying to say. Live as one who is loved completely, and in return you serve as a link to their higher self who is delivering the same message. You must both feel understood, accepted, and loved. And on that basis, the mutual exploration of life can begin to proceed. To be intimate means being yourself. And to grow in intimacy means to be more of yourself every day. Another person has to allow you to do that. You also have to ask to be allowed. It's more than a matter of, I like baseball and you don't, so let me watch it when I want. Although certainly that kind of allowing is very important. The crucial allowing happens emotionally. Both people have to feel safe enough to utter their basic emotional needs. They have to be alone with themselves in order to see every situation as they actually see it. Only then can one feel secure in giving ground to someone else. When you're alone with yourself, then you can begin to see the situation not through the eyes of others. You begin to see it through your own eyes. You see that every situation is eliciting a physiological response in your body, the response to comfort or discomfort. And as you begin to watch this response, then you begin to have insight into the situation as it actually is. The situation is something that you generated. And once you have that insight, then you also get the insight, if I want to change the situation, I can't do it by trying to change others. It hasn't worked in the entire history of mankind. I can do it by changing myself. But most people find that they start living for the other person's response. A wife who cannot stand up to her husband's bad temper will start to hide from it, or placate it, or keep it at a distance with mutual anger. Anytime you see that the other person is coercing or dominating you, resentment sets in. You're not being allowed to be yourself. And in the future, you will feel even less free to express an emotion that is disapproved of. Little by little, intimacy wears away. It gets suffocated by closeness. There is a pitfall here that needs to be avoided. In many intimate relationships, especially those between spouses or lovers, physical intimacy makes it harder rather than easier to communicate. There is much more at risk when sexual rejection is at stake. Paradoxically, two people can find themselves far apart as the result of trying to get too close. Society tells us that once you are married, it is all right to be possessive of another. In the name of love, two people bond emotionally and never pull apart, even when the emotions become something very different from love, over-attachment, domination, submissiveness, resentment. A state of failed intimacy results because the two people are not willing to let each other be alone, which is to say, be themselves. Our society has suffered enormously from the failure of intimacy, which alienates people from each other, even in the bosom of their families. But the deeper tragedy is that an absurd fiction is being promoted, the fiction that the self can be lost. Anyone mired in an unhappy relationship has basically thrown away the self, sacrificing it to a situation where repression, secrecy, guilt and non-communication are the reality. These destructive feelings will always appear if you try to live for another person's approval. In actuality, the self cannot be lost. It is only being disguised, kept out of sight by people who feel that they are unable to feel or speak the truth. Anyone who has taken responsibility for being himself is naturally going to grow in intimacy. Such people eventually realize that for them, spiritual bonding is not a luxury. It is the culminating moment when all those years of being honest and open reveal not just more truth, but God. God is an aspect of the truth as it unfolds, another dimension of the self knowing itself. Truth doesn't exist except as you see it, as you feel it, as you speak its name. Every time you say to a friend, "I want you to know how I really feel," you are experiencing personal truth, as opposed to truth with a capital T. God isn't truth with a capital T either. He exists for you to experience, as an extension of the intimacy you experience with a dearly beloved. There is no higher or lower value here. Knowing God may seem higher than knowing your wife or husband, but both are revealed through self-acceptance. If you're willing to walk the road of self-acceptance to the very end, the time must come when you will see God in another person, opening the possibility that you will see God in yourself. Every time we acknowledge kindness or generosity or openness in another, we are conferring a divine quality, and its source is in us, in our self-conception. Fear makes us hold on in egoistic ways, deluding us into thinking that we are the ones who deserve more recognition, who need more money, who merit more praise. When fear starts to dissolve, the ability to share takes its place. One finds it natural to bestow esteem, money, and praise on others. One no longer has to give out of a desire for reward. The reward is that you are inclusive enough in your own self-worth to be able to share. What is being uncovered here is actually a technique for developing unity consciousness. You are beginning to see yourself in all other beings. Perhaps you're buying a bouquet of flowers and on the way home decide that a friend would really appreciate them more. If yours is a true act of giving, the look of appreciation in your friend's eyes will be magic, for you will see that your gift is being received by more than them. You are giving flowers to yourself, to God, to life everywhere. That is the truth. But one must rise to the state of awareness, completely free of fear and selfishness, where such a truth is spontaneously perceived. We are all on the road to acquiring this sort of refined perception. To go as fast as possible requires just those few things I have already outlined. Be willing to see that your bond with others is not basically psychological or material. It is spiritual, because you are spiritually one with all of life. None of this needs to be forced. You do not have to keep reminding yourself that you are one with the planet. Everything dawns on its own accord, in its own time, according to the laws that govern our inner growth. Keep easily in your mind the reassurance that fear is a deceiver. It is lying when it tells you that self-protection is necessary for survival. Wearing a mask to gain the approval of others may lend you some measure of security, but you will get far more true security by being open, by paying mutual respect to others, and by being real. These attitudes contain enormous power, because by extending mutual respect to someone else, you are giving them freedom. Who really has more power, even in this materialistic world, the tyrant or the liberator? There is genuine love in letting another person alone. True kinship is not trying to possess another's spirit. In return for letting another be free, the two of you will come together, bonded by a sense of complete safety. As you radiate love and security out into your environment, nature will use her infinite power to keep you ever safer, ever more loved. Can you feel this happening already? More and more people have taken that risk to consciously align themselves with love, choosing to act as if they are really cared for in the larger scheme of things. Perhaps the attitude is new to you, but there is nothing to lose in letting go, in trying it out. Living only for yourself, you have only your personal power to support you. Live for the world, and the whole universe welcomes you as its privileged child. The great enemy of renewal is habit. When frozen interpretations from the past are applied to the present, there will always be a gap, a mismatch between the need of the moment and the solution from the past. To have a renewed body, you must be willing to have new perceptions that give rise to new solutions. The exercises which follow are designed to help you open up new perceptions. Be sure to set aside some time to practice these. As you move through the exercises, knowledge and experience will begin to fuse. That's the sign that you are fully assimilating this new worldview in place of the old. The quantum field is transcendent to everyday reality, and yet it is extremely intimate to your experience. To fetch a word from your memory, to have an emotion, these are events that change the entire field. At its finest level, every physiological process registers in the fabric of nature. Here's a simple breathing exercise that can give you a remarkably vivid experience of this phenomenon. Sit comfortably in a chair with your eyes closed. Gently and slowly inhale through your nostrils, imagining as you do that you are drawing the air from a point infinitely far away. Now slowly and easily exhale, sending every atom of air back to its source infinitely far away. Feel each breath coming to you from the quantum field, which at a subtle level is actually happening. Exercise 4. Redefining. Having absorbed the knowledge that your body is not a sculpture isolated in time and space, redefine yourself by repeating the following statements silently to yourself. I can use the power of my awareness to experience a body that is flowing instead of solid, flexible instead of rigid, quantum instead of material, dynamic instead of static, composed of energy and information instead of random chemical reactions, a network of intelligence instead of a mindless machine, fresh and ever-renewing instead of entropic and aging, and timeless instead of time-bound. By repeating these new statements of belief, you are allowing new biological information to be produced. And via the mind-body connection, your redefined sense of yourself is being received by your cells as new programming. Thus, the gap between your old isolated self and the image of yourself as an ageless, timeless being starts to close.